Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah. If you want to go right here, we're going to capture on the mic for. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, good morning. As my mother would say, what a day the Lord has made. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah, you bet. You know, and I appreciate that, Pastor, very, very much. We've had a long relationship. I grew up just down the road in Brighton, Michigan, youngest of five boys. And I don't know how my mother did it, honestly. She is a saint. I know she's looking down right now, giggling at the top of her lungs, for sure. My dad was a shop teacher at Redford Union High School. And when he decided, when the oldest brother, so I'm the youngest of five, got to the age where he was ready to go to high school, my dad said, there is no way I'm having five boys go to this school when I'm teaching here. No way I'm doing that. So his brothers had a little cabin on Woodland Lake, and it was not much to look at. He decided he was going to build that himself. Think of that. Matter of fact, when we first moved in, you could stand up in the upstairs and see down into the basement. I don't even think that's legal today. We would not be able to even move in, although I'm not sure he asked anybody. And he would come home at night, hang drywall, run wire, do plumbing. And I was pretty young. I was five at the time, so I did not much, but I used to carry a bag of nails. I remember that. When he needed nails, he'd give me a holler. He was an amazing guy, an amazing family. And I tell you that story because we really didn't have a lot growing up, five boys. My dad was a teacher. And you think about all the times and struggles that everyone goes through in their life. And when you have five kids that need clothes, and you know, we all kind of shared those clothes. So I became a little bit bigger, so I didn't have to share the clothes. That's what it was. That's what I told my brothers. I don't know if they believe it yet to this day. But I tell you that because this is, after 250 years, an amazing country. We didn't have a big name. We weren't wealthy people. I worked at the Cars and Concepts car factory. Maybe some of you may remember that. We made convertibles that were the Chrysler LeBaron. I don't remember it being the hot-selling convertible. But man, I was grateful for the work because that's the money I needed to help me go through college. My parents helped where they could. But it was important for all of us to work our way through, which we did. I went on to be a member of the United States Congress. I mean, you think of that, unbelievable. You walk into that place, and these are, you know, major figures in American history, a place where George Washington gave his speech in the Capitol building. And I'm thinking, who am I to be here? But this is the country that allows all of that to happen. You can start with not very much. And you can work your way up. You can do your own good and be your own person in your own way, which to me is that American dream. And man, I got to live that in my lifetime. So, and my wife and I, who's here, by the way, Christy Rogers, who is quite amazing in her own self there. Yeah. And when we were thinking about running again, and why we got out is, I just didn't think you should be in Congress forever. I think it changes the way you think. Right, people get a little mushy. They start forgetting about the people they represent. I just thought, listen, we've done a lot. We've accomplished a lot. We have great relationships. Let's pass this baton so someone else can do good for our community. And we voluntarily left. I know it caused a bit of an uproar. Sorry, Pastor. And there's some private sector things that we wanted to do. And I've been in the cybersecurity business for the last 10 years. But then we looked around. And service is important to our family. I served as a United States Army officer. My brother served in Iraq and Afghanistan. My dad served in during the Korean War in the Air Force. My wife's father, my father-in-law, is a retired colonel in the Air Force. Our son is fourth generation in military service in our family, and we're proud of all of that. Matter of fact, I'm proud of my daughter, too, because this is not someone who should be joining the Army. My daughter, love her to death, right? I'm not sure the Army could handle it. But she said, I'm not going to be the only one that didn't do something. And she volunteered with AmeriCorps to put a dental program together on a military basis. And that was the way she served. And she's now going back to school to be an occupational therapist. I mean, she just has that gift of giving back. And we looked at what was happening around the country and in our own state. And we thought, something's wrong. This doesn't feel right. And man, we have to change it. If you think about just some of the things that we're going to have to change. When I was going to school, we were in the top tier of education. We're now 45th in the country. Think of that. We lost 30,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 8 years. 30,000. Those are middle class jobs gone. Hard to get back. You have now the highest auto insurance rates in the country. We're 20% higher than the national average in our utility rates, and I don't know if you noticed, but they're coming back for more. That's broken. They forgot about people who get up and go to work every day is what that tells me. So we looked at it and said, we need to make sure our military is ready to go. We need to make sure that our kids are reading again. We need to make sure that we're fighting for defense industrial-based jobs to keep them here so that we have more opportunity in advanced manufacturing, higher pay, continue to put pressure on prices and energy. We've lost all sight of all of that. Because when you do all of that, this is a phenomenal place to live. We're going to get that back. And that's why we decided to jump back into this and go at it one more time. And service is also in my wife's heart, by the way. I forgot to mention this. She served in Iraq, survived an IED. So we thank God often and every day that she came back to the United States in one piece. And in our family, she has earned the title of tougher than woodpecker lips. That's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. So why did we get back in? And I'll tell you, and the pastor said, don't go on for 4 hours. Although I did bring a slideshow on Texas. It's about 2 hours long. It's fascinating. Kidding. Think of what we can do and what we must do in this go-round. We have to protect our families. With all of the pressure on families today, it's going to be up to us to make sure this goes right and that people can have a godly view and still go to school and not be ostracized. We need to protect our freedoms. There is a whole group out there that wants to take this country in a direction that will take some of our freedoms. And once you give it to the government, I'll guarantee you it is really damn near impossible, excuse my language, to get it back. Yeah. We need to protect our faith. You know, they're chasing God out of schools, and what did we get instead? You can't even say the Pledge of Allegiance in schools anymore. We need to change that. We just need to get people proud of an America, a country that, after 250 years, still does more for the world than any other nation on earth combined, that still has a place in a country where you can work hard and share the fruits of your labor with your family in a way that can take care of your family. Other countries don't have that, but we have it. We can't lose it. We can't lose sight of it. And we can't lose sight of all those pressures. So let's protect our families. Let's protect our freedoms. Let's protect our factories. Let's protect our faith. God bless you. Thank you for having me here. I appreciate it.
So I guess we'll put you in the test a little bit.
Okay.
We had a couple questions. Do you have time for one or two
questions? Sure, yeah, you bet. Just don't make me sing. I was just saying, I have no musical talent whatsoever. I will chase everyone in this church out if I start singing.
The first one we have was, to what do you attribute the rise of socialistic and communistic candidates in our country? Do you feel it's an unusual cycle or something that could have long-term consequences?
Oh, definitely have long-term consequences. Listen, I think we got astray, I don't know, maybe a couple of decades ago, when we decided you couldn't have any display of faith, your personal faith, in school, right? We chased God out, and man, what did we get? You can fly the pride flag, but you can't fly the American flag. I mean, we have lost our way. And I do believe if you lose faith, and there's a generation, if you look at Christianity, is on the decline in the United States. Now, there's some good news in there that I see some young folks in here that rebirth is happening with this next younger generation, but there's a gap in there. And when you walk away from God, I think, or faith, what happens? You try to find something else you believe in. And what the socialists will sell you is if you believe in the government, to do more for you and be in your life, then you don't need God in your life. I think that's exactly how this happens. And if you look at the way they're talking and about their matter of fact, sometimes you don't even think they like America the way they talk. And so that's where I think we have this problem, and it's brewing, and it's real. You look what happened in New York, declared socialist. And by the way, if you want to do a little fun research, go back and look up Hugo Chavez, who took over Venezuela as the first socialist of that country, like practicing socialist. And he would say, I'm not a socialist, I'm a Democrat socialist. Guess what we found out? That just means you added an extra word. It is socialism. He took over the means of production. People were starving just until very recently. Their oil production almost collapsed. You couldn't get electricity 24 hours a day. Their healthcare system collapsed. I mean, just absolutely collapsed. The government can't do it. And believing in the government is only going to cause you trouble. But I do believe there's a whole generation that think, well, this won't happen here. They keep saying, if you listen to them, they keep saying, well, it won't happen here. I got bad news for you. Socialism has a 100% failure rate. Anywhere in the world it's ever been tried, it has failed. We should not blindly walk into this. So I hope that we get faith back in. I hope we protect our liberties to express our faith and have disagreements on some of these cultural issues, which I think is going to be really important going forward in the future. And it will, if we don't fight it now, we're going to have consequences, which is, again, why Christy and I decided, you know what, we've done well in the last 10 years doing the cybersecurity business. This is maybe our chance to give back again. And, you know, our batteries are charged, we're ready to go, and we're ready to fight that fight.
All right. Then the last one is Canada has recently made teaching certain truths of Scripture a crime. What will you do as a United States senator to make sure that doesn't happen here? Yeah.
Thank God Canada does not have a First Amendment, but we do. Freedom of expression is really, really important. So a couple of things. A, we need to protect religious liberty in this country. If there was this movement in maybe, say, the other previous 4 years, I'm careful for you, Pastor, that was pushing this notion that we were going to tell you what to think about transgender ideology, or, you know, fill in the blank, go right down the list. Matter of fact, I'll tell you this story. This is how I knew this was going to be a problem. We have, you know, you ever have a relative that somebody you call your nephew, but they're not really your nephew, but we're so close to their nephew. Well, we have several of those, but one of them, when he was getting ready to go in the eighth grade, and this was about four years ago now, I see him like the week after he started eighth grade, so I was trying to be excited about it. And I asked him, you know, how is it? You love it. You love eighth grade. You're going to be the big man on campus, right, before you get out and go into high school, and trying to get him all pumped up. And he just started staring at his feet. And I said, what's going on, man? I go, Henry, what's going on? He didn't want to talk about it. Okay. So we talked a little bit, and I said, Henry, what's going on? What they did is the very first day of school, when they take the roll call, right, for, you know, who's here and who are you, they said, state your name and state your pronoun. He didn't, A, good faithful family, didn't know what that meant, right? So he's embarrassed. He's eighth grade, right? You, any eighth graders in here, you know what I'm talking about, right? It was hard enough to do that. So he had to try to figure it out by the time they got to him. Why are we doing this to our kids? For what reason do we do this for our kids? So religious liberty and expression has to be protected. So I would absolutely partake. Mike Pence had a protecting religious liberty bill a couple years ago. I don't think it got all the way through. I'd like to kick a little energy under that to make sure that we can protect that liberty. The other part of that is I think we need to make sure that we have judges who are constitutionalists and not activists. And in the last 32 years, where we've had one party represent both of these Senate seats, really difficult to get any Michigan judges that are constitutionalists and not activists. And so my argument is that's going to be the other way you do it. By people, if you read the Constitution, it's pretty clear that we were founded on religious principles. And so you just want them to be able to keep that expression. And we have to passionately support and defend that First Amendment. Canada doesn't have, and I don't know if you've seen what's happened in the United Kingdom, you can get arrested for a Facebook post. They're arresting people who had some harsh words for other religions, right? Just an expression of opinion. You don't have to agree with it. Probably didn't agree with their tactic, but they got arrested. We cannot allow that to happen in the United States of America. I think there's a lot at stake in this election. I hope I answered that question. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All set. Thank you all. God bless you. Thanks for having us. We've got other events to get to today. I appreciate it. I'm sorry I won't get to hear your the sermon today.
It'll be online.
Oh, perfect. I can watch it again. I love that. Yeah, I'll just finish. Yeah, because I love that. Just last story, real quick. I don't know if you guys heard this. This is almost true. There were a politician and a pastor were driving down the road not that long ago, veered off the road. Both of them were killed. It's just a horrible tragedy. But they all get up to the pearly gates. St. Peter happened to be there that day, and the politician stepped up first, wouldn't you know, elbowed the pastor out of the way, and he said, I'm here. And St. Peter says, thank you for being here. Thanks for all you've done. This is amazing. We're going to give you the best place in heaven with the best view. It's just a few short steps away from the good Lord himself. Come on in. Welcome in. And the pastor's thinking, wow, of all the work that I've done, sharing God's grace all of these years, can you imagine what I'm going to get if the politician gets that? And he steps up and he said, Pastor, thank you for being here. Glad you're here. Got a place for you. It's in the basement. It's a little musty. There's a leak in there. We're working on it. It's going to take a little while, but maybe we can get you moved up in a few years. And the pastor says, well, okay, I'm glad to be here. Thank you. But the politician gets the best place in heaven, and I get the basement with the leaky pipe. He said, well, Pastor, you need to understand something. We've never seen a politician here before.
I can't let you, you just have to hang out the door for 1 second, because later in my message, I get to the story about Christian Herter, who was running for governor of Massachusetts. He had experienced days like you day, all day, going from place to place to place. He got to this place, it was a picnic, he was hungry. He went through the feeding line, and the lady handed out the piece of chicken, gave him a piece of chicken, and passed him along to the next stop. He says, I'm really hungry. Can I get a second piece of chicken? And she said, well, nope, one per person. He said, I don't think you know who I am. I'm governor of the state of Massachusetts. I'm running again. She goes, I don't think you know who I am. I'm the lady hanging out the pet, handing out the hat chicken. Move along. I can't remember the point of that in the sermon, but I'll tell it to you all later. But thank you very much for coming. Thank wish you all the best.
Thank you all very much. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the warm welcome, everyone. Appreciate it.
A chauffeur had driven a chemistry professor to a dozen of speaking engagements. He'd heard the speech the professor gave over and over and over again, many times. And he said on the way to the speech, Professor, I've heard your speech so many times, I think I could give it. And the professor, slightly offended, said, I bet you can't. And the chauffeur says, $50 bet, you're on. They pull up, they change clothes real quick. The chauffeur goes and finds his spot at the head table, takes a seat. He's introduced as the speaker. He gets up. He gives the speech verbatim. I mean, he just gave it precisely the way the professor would have given it. And everyone stood up, applauded, and he's standing there. And then the master of ceremonies comes on stage. Says, I believe we have time for a few questions. The first question was asked, and the chauffeur had no idea how to answer the question. He thought for a moment. He cleared his throat, and then he said, I think that's the dumbest question I've ever been asked. So simple, I think my chauffeur could answer it. Well, I suspect you've heard over and over and over again sermons on faithfulness. We're in this little break between America 250 messages and next week starting from the book of Galatians. So what I did is I reworked a little sermon on faithfulness because I think it's one of the most important topics we could talk about. But we've heard a lot. Who couldn't recite some of the verses? He that endureth to the end. Be ye steadfast and unmovable. The man who puts his hand to the plow. I mean, we all know the themes. We've heard it scores of times, but there's some value in repetition, and I hope it benefits you today. Faithful in direction. It's important. Robert Frost wrote in Death of a Hired Man, he had nothing to look back on with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope. Probably the most famous gesture ever made on a baseball field was in the 1932 World Series between the Chicago Cubs and the New York Yankees. It was bottom of the third inning, score tied 4-4, and Babe Ruth came to the plate. He took one strike, and then he pointed to the center field bleachers. Next pitch, strike two. He never moved the bat off his shoulder. But then he pointed again out to the center field bleachers. Next pitch, he hit the ball way deep into the center field bleachers, and the crowd just cheered wildly. You say, man, what if he'd have missed? Well, at least everyone would have known what direction he was trying to go to. Half the wrecks upon life's oceans, if some star had not been their guide, would have safely reached their harbor, but instead drifted with the tide. The ship that doesn't have a port won't hit it. What is your port? What's your direction? Where are you headed? God needs to be driving your life. He needs to be your aim. He needs to be your focus. He needs to be your port. We need to be moving in the direction that he's moving us toward. Isaiah chapter 43 says, fear not, I've redeemed you. I have summoned you by name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burdened. The flames will not set you ablaze, for I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel. Matthew 24 says, Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death. You'll be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. Many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. When Jesus is leading you, there probably will be times of trouble, possibly times of persecution, but we stay the course. A pearl is the product of pain. The shell of an oyster gets pierced, a grain of sand slips inside, and all the resources inside of this tiny little sensitive oyster rush to the spot of irritation, and it releases healing fluids. Soon the irritant is covered and the wound is healed. No other gem has such a fascinating history. A pearl is literally a symbol of stress. It's a healed wound. A pearl is a tiny, precious jewel conceived through irritation, born of adversity, and nursed by adjustment. Had there been no wound, no irritation, there'd be no pearl. Little wonder our heavenly home has at its entrance pearly gates, because those who pass through those gates have been faithful unto death, even despite persecution, pain, troubled times. I like J.B. Phillips' translation of James chapter 1, verses 2 and 4. When all kinds of trials crowd into your lives, my brethren, don't resent them as intruders. Welcome them as friends. Realize they have come to test your endurance, faithfulness. But let the process go on until the endurance is fully developed, and you will find you have become men and women of mature character. So our Lord warned In the last days, men will faint from terror. There'll be tough times. Daniel Boone was once asked if he'd ever been lost. He thought for a moment, he said, "No, I've never been lost, but I will admit I've been bewildered." Well, as we talked over the last 3 weeks about our country and a lot of the good things, I'm a little bit bewildered by some of the bad things. The moral fabric, our general direction in terms of morality. In 1962, we took prayer out of schools. In 1963, we took Bible reading out of schools. It was declared unconstitutional. Those had been symbols of absolute authority, pointing to God. Colossians 1:18 says, "He's the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy." If we don't acknowledge his authority as individuals, as a church, in schools, as a country, we get bogged down in endless arguments deciding what's right and wrong because there's no authority. In 1980, they took the Ten Commandments off the school walls, said they can't be placed there anymore. We're just going in the wrong direction. The foundations are being shaken. Everything that was nailed down is coming loose. In those 20 years, the first 20 years, after 1963, when the Bible couldn't be read in schools, prayers couldn't be uttered, teenage pregnancies doubled. Sexually transmitted diseases went up 276%. The suicide rate amongst teenagers doubled. SAT scores went down 18 consecutive years. They've never really recovered. I don't doubt our country because I think we're the greatest nation on earth, and you know that if you were here the last few weeks. But America's not just the leader in terms of a lot of good things. We're the leader in some bad things, too. We're number one in violent crimes, number one in divorces, number one in abortions, number one in illegal drug use, number one in teenage pregnancies in the Western world. Judges 17:6 says, "In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit, and the result was chaos." And we're seeing that same type of chaos in our country as people rebel against authority. I worry what's going to happen in our country and in our churches and in our schools in the next 20 years if that doesn't begin to reverse course. The only way we can reverse that is to stay true to biblical principles. It begins first with us individually, us as a church, and trying to share that with others. We need a revival, much like that of the Great Awakening. Here's your question. Will you be faithful or will you be a coward? Times in the early 80s started to get so bad that people began to turn to people like Ann Landers and Dear Abby for spiritual advice. Ann Landers one time reported that she received a letter that went like this: "Dear Ann, I am in love with two women and enjoy being with both. I'm not interested in marriage and don't give me any of that morality stuff. What should I do?" She wrote back, "Dear sir, the only difference between humans and animals is morality. I suggest you write your veterinarian for advice." We desperately need faithfulness, and it's spelled salt and light. Well, faithful in doctrine, that's essential. The story is told of a man going to the dentist. He's sitting in the dentist chair. He's going to have a tooth extracted. The problem was every time the dentist would put the clamps onto the tooth, the man would bite down on them. The dentist did everything he could think of, and it wasn't working. And in desperation, he finally asked his female assistant, "Hey, would you please, if he bites on those pliers again, just pinch him. Reach behind the back of the chair with your long fingernails and pinch his bottom side. He'll be shocked. He'll open his mouth. I'll pull the tooth." Well, the man did exactly as they presumed he would. Dennis put the pliers in. He clamped down on them. The assistant pinched his bottom side with authority, and the dentist pulled the tooth. After it was all done, the dentist said, "See, it wasn't that bad now, was it?" And the man said, "No, but I had no idea the roots went that deep." I am not ashamed of my roots. Are you? 1995, I was asked to speak at the graduating class of Cincinnati Bible College, and I included these remarks. I said, if you preach the gospel and leave out baptism, you're not being faithful. If you water down the gospel in any way, shape, or form to try and help get a crowd, you're preaching in error. If you preach that it is a sin to drink, a sin to dance, a sin to play cards, you're making things up that aren't in the Bible. You're not being faithful. If you don't preach things that are in the Bible, like the respect of life, the sanctity of marriage, you're not being faithful. If you accept a call as a Christian and you accept it, if you get a call as a Christian and you accept it, we're called to be faithful to God's word at every point. And I told us preachers, you are called to stand on that unwaveringly, because methods are many, doctrines are few. Methods can change, but doctrines never do. And I remember distinctly in that message saying something I had heard someone else predict, and I repeated it. I said, over the next 10 years, you will see churches start to pop up that exclude the name of the words Christian, church, God, or Christ, or anything like that from their name as a church. That they would exclude anything that typically associates the congregation with traditional biblical principles. I said, instead, you might get invited to go to the well or the fountain. The well, what for? To get a drink? To hoist a pail? And what's the point? Because as society drifts further and further and further from God, we just don't want to tie ourselves as close to Him as we used to, at least not so obviously. Things like the church, God, Bible, Christianity will begin to appeal less and less and less to independent people, and generics and nonspecifics and watered-down messages will be what people want to hear. But what will we be convincing them of? Apathy? Paul said, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation. I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed of my Christian roots. I'm not ashamed of my Bible. I'm not ashamed of my God. I'm not ashamed of my Lord. I urge you to be unashamedly active in your faith as well. I read in the Reader's Digest about a show-and-tell period in kindergarten. One little child brought a kitten to share with the class. Is it a boy or a girl kitten? Someone in the class asked. And the little girl said, oh, I'm not sure. And one of the child spoke up and says, oh, I know how we can tell real quickly. And someone said, how? He says, we can vote on it. Well, you can vote on anything until the cows come home, but that doesn't change truth. Truth, said Winston Churchill, is truth. Panic may resent it, ignorance may deride it, malice may distort it, but there it is. Zig Ziglar said, I believe for the Bible from Genesis through the maps. Right? The following are words on the gravestone of a preacher. He was a preacher of the gospel, not taught by sect or parties, but the pure and glorious word taught by Christ and his apostles. We live in an age of instant gratification. We want things, and we want them now. And sometimes that comes to be true even in churches. We want church growth. And if we don't get it right now when we want it, as quick as we want it, there's this tendency to hit the panic button. And sometimes it leads to compromise. But yet we're called to be unique. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. We're called to be true to thus saith the Lord. Doctrine's so important. But our attitude is equally important. Permit me to suggest strongly, you can be as doctrinally sound as the downtown church of Jerusalem and not make it to heaven due to bad attitude. He that hath not the Spirit of Christ is none of his, Scripture says. Shortly after becoming an ordained minister, I met a sharp 25-year-old young man. He came to our church when I was a youth minister at the Christian Church of Wyandotte. I said, Matt, how'd you become a Christian? He had such a unique story. He said, well, I didn't grow up a Christian. I grew up in high school living a pretty hedonistic type lifestyle. He said, in fact, I was on spring break. I was down in Florida during my senior year with my best friend. We went to Panama City. He said, everything you see on the news or everything you hear about going on in Florida during spring break, I did it all. But all week long, we kept seeing this tent and this sign that said Campus Crusade, free breakfast. He was everywhere we went. We saw signs that said Campus Crusade, free breakfast. We didn't know what Campus Crusade was. He says, but Friday of that week, we were broke, we were drunk, and we were stoned. He said, I finally suggested, let's go to the Campus Crusade tent. They'll give us food. He said they did. They made us a nice breakfast. And this really nice Campus Crusade worker came down, sat across the table from us, and talked to us about God, Jesus, and the Bible. He shared his testimony. He goes, we tried to brush him off. We were just there for breakfast. But he kept talking, and he was polite, but he kept talking. He goes, and then I went home, but I couldn't get him off my mind. He said, we flew home Saturday night. I'm sitting in my mother's living room, and I'm feeling guilty about everything we had just done the week before. He said, I didn't know anything about the convicting power of the Holy Spirit. I still don't understand a lot about it, he said, but I felt awful. He said, I called my friend up. I said, hey, tomorrow I'm picking you up. We're going to church. And his friend's like, what are you talking about? He said, I'm picking you up, and we're going to church. He said, Randy, we never went to church ever, except for maybe Christmas Eve services. And when we did, my mother would brought us right here to the Christian Church of Wyandotte. So that's where he came. He said the very first word that came out of Brother Jim's mouth when he got up to preach that morning were, you won't believe who's in church today. He's the biggest boozer and drinker you've ever seen in my life. He said, my friend was sitting next to me, nudged me. He said, how'd he know you were here? Brother Jim was preaching that day about the sinful woman in the Bible who had repented and was totally forgiven by Christ. She was so overwhelmed that she anointed Jesus' feet with oil and wiped them with her tears, anointed his feet with her tears and then wiped it with her hair. My friend said, sometimes the most unlikely people come to Christ. He said, as he was preaching, it was almost as if there was no one else in the room. He says, tears were filling my eyes. I didn't know what was happening. He goes, as soon as the service was over, I raced out. He goes, but I came back the next week, and the same thing happened. And when the invitation was given, I walked forward. I gave my life to Christ. He goes, I was baptized. He says, tears flooded my eyes, but this time I knew what it was. He says, I knew I was like that sinful woman from the week before. And I knew I was being forgiven. And I felt whole. And I felt new in Jesus Christ. And I wish you could see him today. He's now a Christian grandfather, having raised his children in the Lord, having started a youth group at a church he went. He went out and sought a small church because he wanted to be active and help that church grow. He said he wanted to make a difference in the lives of other people. The church he went to grew from 44 members the first day he went there to over 400 12 years later. I've often thought about him, and I've thought about that story. And when I think about it, I can't help but think there's some Campus Crusade worker in Panama City, Florida, that has no idea what the seed he planted produced. And I just say to you, you have no idea what you might accomplish by saying the right word of encouragement, the right word of hope, the right word of truth to somebody that you come across in your life. You have no idea what can happen from that one seed you plant when you invite one person to church someday. I'll digress just a minute to tell you another story that kind of goes along with this. 1986, I was in my first ministry as an intern in Nashville, Ohio. Nashville is a small little town in Holmes County, Ohio, has one traffic light, less than 200 people live there. The Church of Christ there was over 100 years old. They had 60 members, very much like our congregation in many ways. They had a very old church building, very dedicated group of believers, folks who wanted a large dynamic ministry. Who lived in Nashville literally went 20 miles in any given direction to find a bigger church. But this one little core group of believers in Nashville stuck together. And they did that for over 100 years. Becky and I went there a few years back, and I was surprised when we drove past going down the going through the highway and drove past, and I saw that building. It was vacant, and nobody was meeting there. And then a little ways down was a brand new church building. Found out they had built it. Over 300 people now attending Nashville Church of Christ in a community where there are less than 200 citizens. I asked Jim Alexander, now in heaven, but an elder, what happened. He said they had an elders meeting where the elders unanimously agreed they weren't fulfilling the Great Commission. And they dedicated themselves to reaching out, to sharing the gospel. And so for those here who want to grow, our history of a smaller attendance means nothing, other than the fact we've been faithful in our attendance over the years and to our Lord over the years as individuals. But what's worth focusing on is not what we're doing now, but what we want to do and what we want to become and whose power we want to work within to make all those things happen. Do we have the will to do what it takes? Do 20 of us want to do what it takes? My favorite story about the idea of changing your ways and getting past your lack of flexibility concerns this poor guy named Christian Herter, governor of Massachusetts. I won't tell you the whole story again, but he's the chicken guy I talked about at the beginning. And the point was at the end, now I remember what it was, my mind's back, but sometimes it's okay to change your methods. Sometimes it's okay to give out a second piece of chicken, right? Sometimes it's okay to change how you do things if there's a better way to get them done. Faithful in destination, finally, it's imperative. Moses was faithful. At 80 years old, he led 3.5 million people out of captivity. Caleb was faithful. At 85, he said, I want to take this mountain for God. Joseph was faithful in the midst of unbelievable temptation in the Bible. Daniel was faithful in a very hostile environment. David was faithful, returning to return home at the bidding of his brothers. When his brother said, go home, little boy, he said, I'm staying. I'm going to defeat Goliath. Gideon was faithful, and he proved you can do more with less if God's there. When a bricklayer is faithful, he becomes a mason. When a typist is faithful, she becomes a secretary. When a carpenter is faithful, he becomes a builder. When a cook is faithful, she becomes a chef. When a bookkeeper is faithful, he becomes an accountant. When a plumber is faithful, he becomes a pipe fitter. When a speaker is faithful, he becomes an orator. When a boss is faithful, he becomes an executive. When a painter is faithful, he becomes a decorator. When a preacher is faithful, he becomes a prophet. When a Christian is faithful, he becomes a missionary. When I get to that wonderful city and all the saints around me appear, I want to have someone there tell me it was you who invited me here. I mentioned a lot of Bible characters earlier. I also like Noah. He was faithful. Genesis 6:22, Noah did everything just as God commanded him. It's not always easy, y'all, to go the prescribed route. Heard the weather report at 11 o'clock last night. No sign of rain. In fact, only 10 inches all year. You say a flood's coming? Build an ark? That's strange. God does that. He defies logic. Noah did it. He cut the woods cut. It's trimmed. It's laid out on the ground. People come by. What are you doing? Build an ark? A boat in the sand? Where's it going to float? Right here. Flood's coming. Noah was faithful regardless of what his neighbors said. The workmen, the public opinion didn't matter. When is it time to build an ark? The time to build an ark is when God speaks to you through his word and you feel the urging and the leading of the Holy Spirit to build an ark. Shakespeare wrote, there is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood of fortune, omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallow and miseries. Shakespeare is hard to understand still to me to this day. In plain words, he was saying, eat the biscuit while it's hot. Jesus said it in John chapter 9, I must do the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. I don't have the sense that we have a lot of time. Has God spoken to your heart about doing something for him? Something significant for him? The biscuit's hot. In Matthew 25, 25, faithfulness demanded actions. Our Lord made it abundantly clear that he will not tolerate the status quo. Faithfulness is risky business. If it's not risky, it's not faith. Edgar A. Gust wrote, "I'd like to think when life is done that I had filled a needed post, that here and there I'd paid my fare with more than idle talk and boast, that I had taken gifts divine, the breath of life and manhood find, and tried to use them now and then in service for my fellow men. I'd hate to think when life is through that I had lived my round of years, a useless kind that leaves behind no record in this vale of tears, that I had wasted all my days by treading only selfish ways, and that this world would be the same if it had never known my name." Doesn't matter what your post is in life, you will be remembered if you're faithful. I heard this morning that Bill Estey had passed away. Who's Bill Estey? Most people don't know. Most people in this world don't know. He worked as an engineer at BASF in Wyandotte, Michigan. But he was one of the youth coaches that trained me when I was young. He was partners to Kerrig and Carol Larson in starting the Bible Bowl ministry at the Christian Church of Wyandotte. Bill Estey is known by a lot of Christian folks because he touched a lot of lives, and he's faithful to God. Fox News won't notice that he passed, but the angels of heaven did. He was faithful. "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter in the joy of your master." I'm a little over, but I want to share one more quick story. I promised the worship team I'd cut out, but I did cut out a lot of my message this morning. Lieutenant John Blanchard was stationed in Florida during World War II. One evening, he wandered into a library and found a book to read. As he worked his way through the book, he became impressed, not with the content of the book, but with the notes that were penciled in the margins of the book. The feminine handwriting showed insight and understanding that was just tender to him. He flipped the front of the book and he found the name of the previous owner of it, and it was a Miss Hollis Maynell. Blanchard did some research and he found her address. It was, she lived in New York State. He wrote her a letter. The following days, he got shipped overseas. For 13 months, they corresponded back and forth. They opened their hearts to each other. They realized over that long course of time, they were literally falling in love with each other, though they'd never met, but only through these letters. He requested a picture, but she refused, saying if he really loved her, it wouldn't matter what she looked like. Finally, after 14 months, the day came when they would meet. The place? New York City, Grand Central Station. The time? 7 p.m. She would be carrying a rose, and he would be in uniform carrying the book that started their love affair. It was now 1 minute of 7. He straightened up his uniform. His heart was pumping with anxiety. A true story. Lieutenant Blanchard says it in his own words. He said, "A young woman came toward me. Her figure was long and slim. Her hair was blonde with curls. You could see a glimpse of delicate ears. Her eyes were blue as flowers. Her lips and chin had a gentle firmness. She wore a pale green suit and looked like spring had come alive. I started toward her, entirely forgetting to notice that she was not carrying a rose. As she passed, a small provocative smile curved her lips. 'Going my way, soldier?' Almost uncontrollably, I made one step in her direction, and then I saw the woman with the rose. There she was, well past 40, graying hair tucked under her worn hat. More than plump, her thick ankled feet were thrust into low-heeled shoes, but she had a rose. The girl in the green suit was quickly walking away, and I felt like I was to split in two. I had a keen desire to follow that beautiful woman who had just passed, yet I had a longing for the woman whose spirit had truly companioned to me all these years. There she stood. Pale, plump face was gentle and sensible. Her gray eyes had a warm twinkle. I didn't hesitate. My fingers gripped the small worn book that would identify me. This may not be true love, I thought, but it would be something precious, a friendship for which I will ever be grateful. I squared my shoulders and I held the book out to the woman and said, I am Lieutenant John Blanchard and you must be Miss Maynell. I'm so glad to finally meet you. May I take you to dinner? The woman's face is broadened with a smile and she says, I don't know what all this is about, soldier, but the young lady in the green dress just begged me to carry this rose. She said, if you were to ask me to dinner, I should tell you she's waiting for you in that restaurant across the street. Then she asked me, is this some kind of test? Lieutenant Blanchard passed the test. Will you? Christianity is the name. Faithfulness is the game, and heaven is the claim.